Scranton, Pennsylvania Mayor Bill Courtwright, who resigned this week, has entered into a plea agreement on three federal charges, including bribery and conspiracy. Court documents allege Courtwright received campaign contributions, cash, even landscaping work at his home from businesses looking to do work in the city.
J.P. Morgan raised the risk of recession next year to 43% from 24%. The president's trade war's a big reason. A year in, tariffs now seem to be a permanent condition, not a bargaining chip.
We think there's a great long-term potential upside in cannabis investing. We think there's great future potential. We've even compared it to, you know, decades and decades ago, the end of prohibition in alcohol. We think there's a similar thing in cannabis.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, 509. Steve Grzanich is off this morning. My name is Mark Carmen. Hope you're having a great 4th of July weekend as we've hit Friday, July 5. A lot going on. For the opening bell this morning, Dale Buss contributed Forbes, the Wall Street Journal, and the Chief Executive magazine is going to join us in a matter of moments. And we're also going to talk with Robert Kidd a little bit after 5:30. He's a freelance journalist in Valencia, Spain, which I have actually been to Valencia. It's a beautiful part of the world. He covers the sports business, focusing on Europe and soccer, and a lot going on with the World Cup and video assistant replay, which we will be touching on after 5:30. Markets are open today, and right now, just checking out what's going on as far as the pre-market, the Dow futures are trending down 42 points, S&P is down 6.75 points, the NASDAQ down 20.25 points, and the Russell down 5.5 points. Big stuff going on today as far as the dollar, which was firm so far today. Traders are holding off on making big bets ahead of the closely watched U.S. non-farm jobs report that's going to come out later today. The focus on whether Friday's U.S. jobs report will help make or break the case for a rate cut later in July. And economists who've been polled by Reuters are predicting that U.S. non-farm payrolls to have increased by 160,000 in June from 75,000 in May. So that news coming out later today. Let us move along and bring in Dale Buss again, who's a contributor at Forbes, the Wall Street Journal, Chief Executive Magazine. Dale, welcome to 720 WGN. Thanks for getting up. Happy 4th of July weekend to you.
Likewise, and thank you.
It is our pleasure to have you on the air this morning. Let's start with Lee Iacocca, you know, who passed away couple days ago, 94 years old, and just a legend in the automobile industry. Of course, going over to Chrysler from Ford. For you, what is, I guess, the legacy of Lee Iacocca when you look back at all he contributed?
Well, there are several things. I mean, first of all, he saved Chrysler, and when you think about the tens of thousands of jobs involved with Chrysler back in the 1980s, as well as today. You think about another tens of thousands of jobs at suppliers and sort of what any major automaker means to the U.S. economy. That's a huge accomplishment in and of itself, and we can talk a little bit more about how he did that. Second, Iacocca was one of the original Made in America guys, if you will. Long before Donald Trump, you know, made that a campaign trope, Iacocca made it happen. He didn't, you know, he didn't just talk about it. He was an industrial leader who, through his charisma and leadership and vision, preserved American jobs. He also, like Donald Trump, actually was very highly critical of trade policies at the time. His whipping boy kind of was Japan, not China, and that was a time when Japanese imports were first flooding into America and really taking over a huge part of the auto market. And I guess a third thing about Iacocca was that he was our first celebrity CEO, and that's kind of how I described him and what I wrote about him in chiefexecutive.net the other day. we've been kind of used to that sort of persona leading a business over the last few decades. But with his advertising, which was meant as kind of a desperation measure to save Chrysler, you know, he came out and said, if you can find a better car, buy it. And he was such a convincing salesperson, which was really the basis of his career, that people went out and bought, they were called K cars by the millions. And these were models like the Dodge Aries and the Plymouth Reliant. They weren't that great. They were front wheel drive, which was kind of interesting technology, but you know, in terms of quality and just anything distinctive about them, there wasn't much there. But Lee Iacocca was telling people to buy them and help save Chrysler and help save America, if you will. And people went out and did that. And so we still have Chrysler today in the form of Fiat Chrysler.
It's funny that you mentioned the Dodge Aries, because that was my first car, Dale. Hand me down from my beautiful, wonderful aunt. I think we gave her $1,500 for it. It was light blue. It was awful, but it worked. It got me.
There you go. So she probably, you know, drank the Iacocca Kool-Aid, and there you are. And you know what? There are still K cars on the road today. I mean, I've got an elderly neighbor who's driving one. I can't even believe that it's still running. But you know, these were people who said, "Hey, Lee Iacocca said I should buy one. Maybe that's a consideration."
Let's rewind back to something you touched on a couple seconds ago, and how exactly he saved Chrysler. I know that the minivan was a big part of that, and he advocated strong for it, and that made him a ton of dough. What else would you say?
Well, before we got to the minivan, what Iacocca did was prevailed upon the federal government, and this was an incredible game of salesmanship, an incredible achievement, because it was bipartisan. He got the federal government, and this was in the early 1980s, 1979, 1980, when America was in the midst of recession. And he said, if you give us $1.5 billion in loan guarantees, we'll pay you back and you'll save the company. Now, these days, $1.5 billion seems like nothing. And it is nothing, I guess, when it comes to the federal treasury. But it was a huge amount of money in the early 1980s. And Iacocca managed to put this all together, and it worked. And not only did it save Chrysler federal guarantees, you know, enabled Chrysler to put out the K cars and get back on their feet, but a few years later, Iacocca repaid the U.S. taxpayer with interest. And, you know, and think ahead to 2008 when the federal government had to bail out Chrysler, you know, much later, obviously. So that was his most amazing accomplishment. And in terms of product, you mentioned the minivan. I mean, Iacocca became famous by rising through the ranks in sales at Ford. And he glopped onto an idea in the early 60s for the Mustang. He had a product guru at Ford named Hal Sperlich, who developed the Mustang. And Iacocca was smart enough to see that in that era, Americans would love a pony car, you know, a fast, distinct car that said something about them. And so he backed the Mustang. It was a hit. Henry Ford II, who was running Ford at the time, just didn't like Iacocca. You know, a lot of people think they were jealous of Iacocca having the kind of public persona that Henry Ford just didn't have. And so he fired him. And so Iacocca wasn't long after that Iacocca landed at Chrysler. You mentioned the minivan. That was truly a remarkable achievement. And again, something that Hal Sperlich came up with. Iacocca had brought him to Chrysler. Iacocca was smart enough to see that this was a niche that Chrysler could dominate by bringing out the first minivan. And indeed, that's what they did in 1983. And so while minivan sales today, you know, have lagged quite a bit, they still represent hundreds of thousands of vehicles a year. And Chrysler dominated that market for many, many years. And it was just one of those very unusual, brand new categories that popped up in the auto business because of Iacocca's foresight.
Dale, can you hang in there? We got to take a little quick time out. I want to touch on the getting forced out by Ford. And he actually eventually got forced out by Chrysler. And So I'd like to touch on that. And I got one other story that I want to work with you on, which is about Barbara Humpton, who is the CEO for Siemens USA, and what they're doing as far as trying to empower your standard Joe, who I don't think I can do code here, Dale, but maybe I can. So,
okay, absolutely.
We'll explain that coming on back. Let's take a quick time out, and we'll be back with Dale Buss on the opening bell. This is 720 WGN. Let's check some stocks early on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. Thank you. A couple of stocks, local interest right now. Apple is continuing to rise up at 204. And 41 cents up $1.68 in its last trading session. McDonald's is just rolling, 212 and 81 cents up $3.23. And also, let's look at Microsoft, which we'll touch on here coming up, 137 and 46 cents up nearly a dollar. As we get back with Dale Buss, I was expecting a rejoin, my bad.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now. A new look is out today on jobs across the country. Economists had been expecting that this morning's report from the Labor Department shows about 160,000 jobs were created last month. That'd be more than double the number created in May. Oil prices falling this morning amid more worries that slowing economic growth around the world could put the brakes on demand. Crude oil futures in the U.S. are off just over 1%. OPEC, seeing the lower demand, has committed to cut production to help prop up prices. Two of the world's biggest car companies are teaming up to work on automated driving technology. BMW and Daimler say about 1,200 developers spread across the two companies will now start sharing information. And Amazon could soon face a whole bunch of new lawsuits. A federal appeals court has ruled that Amazon can be held liable for defective products sold on its platform by third-party vendors. More than half of the business on Amazon sites is actually handled by other companies who just use Amazon's platform to sell to customers. Dave Packer, ABC News.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
There we go, my bad. Let's keep it rolling here. Opening bell, Mark Harmon with you. Dale Buss joining us. She contributed at Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, Chief Executive Magazine. As we're talking about Lee Iacocca and more, who passed away at 94 years old. Dale, welcome back in here.
Thanks.
What's interesting for me for Lee, this here's an incredibly successful guy, and you touched on it. I mean, dominant, for lack of a better word, at Ford, saves Chrysler, but he got forced out by both companies. And you mentioned that perhaps, you know, he's the face of the company, he's doing commercials. What was he doing behind the scenes, I guess, that rubbed people the wrong way, to your knowledge?
Well, I don't know if it was behind the scenes, actually. I mean, what Iacocca did was pretty upfront. It's just that his shtick, if you will, started wearing thin after a while, because even though Chrysler had survived the 1980s, you know, we were heading into the late 1980s, and Chrysler, GM, and Ford all faced this huge obstacle in Japanese competition, which Iacocca had talked about. Japanese products became the byword for quality in the auto industry, and the Detroit 3 just could not match them. And so imports like the Toyota Camry, the Honda Accord, started just chomping up huge shares of the U.S. auto market, and Iacocca, you know, obviously Chrysler was trying to make better products, but he kind of went on a rampage about Japanese products, demonizing, you know, the companies and the products, saying this is a Teflon kimono that Japan had, and that Chrysler could make better cars than Japanese anyway. So he went on about that. And then he made some decisions that weren't so great. He bought a little company called American Motors. You may remember weird products like the Gremlin, for example, which is kind of a rolling greenhouse, if you will. And he bought American Motors, didn't work out very well. He went on to try to put Chrysler on a better footing for the future. He established a partnership with Mitsubishi and another with Maserati. They didn't work out all that well. And so what ended up happening is that eventually, in the early 90s, there was pressure on Iacocca, because he just hadn't hit many home runs lately. And so he hired a guy named Robert Eaton, who was the head of GM's European operations, as his designated successor. And he retired as Chrysler's chairman and CEO in 1992.
And he did a ton of charity work after that, correct?
Yeah, and in the meantime, Iacocca had become this larger-than-life figure. People eventually talked about him very seriously as a Democratic presidential candidate. He never really took up that idea, but he would have been a very highly credible candidate to run against Reagan. But what he did do is he chaired the commission that was put together to restore the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island, which had fallen into great disrepair, in raising hundreds of millions of dollars to put Lady Liberty back on her pedestal, if you will. It was a great achievement for the company. Iacocca's parents had been Italian immigrants. He grew up in Pennsylvania. His dad was a hot dog vendor. And Iacocca was, associated with Italian-Americans very proudly as he rose in his career. And so that was something that he wanted to do for the country later in his business career.
Dale, you wrote about him at chiefexecutive.net, correct? If people want to read more, I mean, there's a ton of stuff out there. But,
exactly.
You've got stuff.
Yeah, if you want to read my tribute, it's there at chiefexecutive.net.
Chiefexecutive.net. I mean, just a huge, huge figure in American business, and obviously specifically the car industry. Dale, great to have you on this morning. Appreciate you taking time, and we look forward to talking to you, or Steve Grzanich looks forward to talking to you specifically down the road here. So thanks so much for jumping on.
Absolutely. I enjoy it. Thank you.
All right. Dale Buss with us here on 720 WGN, the opening bell. Lee Iacocca, 94 years old. Imagine that. I'm going to work for Ford. I'm going to work up my way up through the ranks, and I'm going to get moved out. I'm going to go save Chrysler, and then at the end of your life, you're going to do everything you can, giving back charity-wise. That's quite a run, right? 94 years doing a lot for business and cars and whatnot for this country. Incredible just to think about everything that guy had in his life and where he came from. All right, quick time out here. We'll get you a check of news coming on back here. And we've got a look at the tech trends right now.
Hi, this is Catherine Davis from Chicago Inno with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio. Chicago on-demand parking app Spot Hero and navigation app Waze are partnering to make it easier to navigate your parking place. Drivers can book parking on Spot Hero and then navigate with Waze directly to their parking spot within the app. A tap on the Waze map pulls up the Spot Hero parking pass to access the garage, eliminating the need to switch back and forth. Cameo, an app that lets you buy shout-out messages from celebrities, raised $50 million in a Series B round led by Kleiner Perkins, the Silicon Valley venture capital firm known for its investments in companies like Google, Amazon, and Netscape. The new round reportedly values Cameo at around $300 million. And Showpad, a Belgium-based sales enablement tech company that has a large Chicago presence, raised a $70 million round of funding as it looks to add jobs to its 7 offices across the globe. The round, led by Dawn Capital and Insight Partners, will allow Showpad to add 35 new jobs in Chicago. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, 5:36. Steve Grzanich off today. My name is Mark Carmen in for Steve, and then we'll be sitting in with Jisoo Gi, Dave Bennett, and company on the Steve Cochran Show this morning. Robert Kidd is a freelance journalist, works in Valencia, Spain. Is that right, Robert? That's where you're based out of? That's a beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, that's right, Mark.
All right, I just, when I had my midlife crisis at 30 years old, my first one, Robert, I got another one coming at some point here. I did the 2-month Europe travels, staying in hostels, whatnot, and Valencia was one of my stops.
Fantastic.
Yes, it was a beautiful time, and I'd go back again. It was awesome. All right, but you are here to talk amongst a bunch of stuff, but we're going to start with video assistant referee, which we are seeing play out in the World Cup, and we've seen it before the World Cup, but we certainly are seeing it right now. For those who don't know what they call VAR is, can you do at least a brief explanation of what we're talking about here?
Sure.
Sure, yeah. So VAR essentially means video assistant referee, and it's set up to essentially help the on-field referee in a soccer match. So its function really is to be a bit of a support to the referee and to advise them to check, or they can also overrule a key decision on pitch. For example, it might be a goal ruled out for offside, as we saw in the England-United States semi-final of the Women's World Cup, or it might be overturning a red card decision if the VAR feels it wasn't an appropriate red card. But yeah, really key decisions like that.
Right, so, and I think, you know, if football fans are listening, or baseball fans right now, you know, in baseball in America, the a manager will call for a replay. They'll go, they'll walk off to the side, they'll put the headphones on, and they'll go to New York, and New York will sit there and watch the replay and tell them safe and or out or whatever it is. Video assistant referee, it's one guy, the referee, walking over to a monitor. He puts on the whatever you want to call it, the techno headset thing, and it's all him, right? He's not getting any help from anyone else. It's just his decision or her decision watching the replay.
Correct. They have the final decision, but there is a team of VARs or video assistant referees, similar to like you were saying. They'll be in a studio somewhere with access to video replays, and their job is to say to the referee through the headpiece, look, we think you should have another look at that penalty decision, for example. Or even they can say, you've just given a goal, but actually we've had a look and it was offside, so you should not give that goal now. So they do have a little bit of help, but yeah, we've seen quite a few times during this World Cup, the referee go to that pitch side monitor and have to just look there, with, of course, thousands of fans booing or cheering them, depending on which way they want the decision to go. But yeah, have a look at that decision on the pitch and then make the decision if it was correct or overrule the original decision.
Okay, so but the accuracy of the decisions reportedly have increased by about 6% to nearly 99% using VAR. But there is, you say, there, Robert, sounds like you don't like it, but we'll get to that in a second. There is the human element, right? If especially on a penalty, was that too physical? Was it not? Was he grabbing? Was it in the spirit of play? So it's not. There's a judgment even when you're using VAR that fans, at least a lot of fans, seemingly do not like. I mean, what's your opinion on whether or not that VAR is actually really helping the game? Because sometimes it's not just over the line or not over the line. There's a lot of decisions that still need to be made by a human, and whether or not that play was actually in the spirit of the game.
Sure, I think that's a really important point. And obviously with soccer, it's different to other sports, say tennis, for example, which has Hawkeye technology, you know, to determine whether the ball is in or out, if it's on the line, if it's not on the line. Soccer has only introduced goal line technology in 2012, so it's still quite a recent thing. And I think part of that reluctance to embrace technology has been because a lot of decisions are so open to interpretation. Like you say, a handball, is it deliberate, is it not deliberate? I mean, referees would disagree on some decisions like that. In terms of my own personal opinion, I actually think VAR is a good thing for the game. I think it will be a positive thing. I think if you look at the research that's been done, led by a chap called Professor Werner Helsen in Belgium, he looked at decisions in nearly 1,000 matches, and they did find, as you said, that accuracy increased. And also there were fewer what you'd call game-changing errors. So to me, that's a good thing. I think the problem we've seen in this tournament is the way VAR has been used is perhaps not the way it was designed to be used. The philosophy behind it is supposed to be minimal interference, maximum benefit, meaning it will only be used to correct what they call clear and obvious errors. I think what we've seen too much at this World Cup is referrals for incidents, which are, again, very open to interpretation. A handball, a penalty, like you said, there's too much contact. Was it a shirt pull? Was it not enough to be a penalty? And if you look at an incident, as we all know, if you look at an incident in any sport enough times from enough different angles in slow motion, suddenly it might look like a lot more like, for example, a deliberate handball than it does in real time. And we've seen referees, you know, watching replays at the side of the pitch a dozen times in slow motion. And for me, if you're still not 100% sure after watching it that many times, well, that's not a clear and obvious error, in my opinion.
Robert Kidd, freelance journalist, Valencia, Spain, with us here on the opening bell on 720 WGN. Mark Harmon in for Steve Krasanich. All right, so you're starting to touch on what really bothers me about replay, which is I like to live in a gray world here, Robert, and replay, they're trying to get to black and white. Was it off his hand for basketball, for soccer? There was one play with a Scottish keeper, Lee Alexander, who stopped the first penalty kick, but then they look at the review, and she was just off the line, so they redid it. And by the letter of the law, they were right to redo it. But in the spirit of the game, most goalies do exactly what she did, and they reversed it. Yeah. So, for instance, in basketball, you know, if you knock the ball off someone's out of bounds, at the park, at the rec league, in high school, whatever, it is out of bounds. But now if you slow it down to the meaningless second, you can see that, oh my God, it might have hit the end of his pinky. But that's not the spirit of the game. So I don't know where we go from here, but if we're really going to do it by frame, by frame, by frame, by frame, by frame, slowing down the game, and then you're taking away the actual spirit of what just happened, to me that's a real slippery slope. I don't know how you see it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, that penalty decision, like you mentioned, for Scotland, that just seemed like an incredibly harsh decision, really. And I suppose, similarly, I mentioned earlier, but and this isn't me being patriotic, but the goal that England scored against the United States that was then correctly ruled out for offside, I mean, it was such a close decision. And it's like you say, do we want that? Do we want that as fans or as viewers of the game, that decisions are made on the absolute letter of the law by, you know, it can be inches at times? Or do we want a bit of leeway there where, you know, it is open to interpretation? And I think that's a conversation that, you know, FIFA needs to have as the governing body, but also with supporters and teams. Are we willing to accept a decision if it's wrong, but it's so close that it's still, I guess, in the spirit of the game?
Yeah, well, this is all stuff that's going to have to be worked out with some intelligent conversation. Robert Kidd, freelance journalist of Valencia, Spain. As far as the World Cup this year, Robert, what would you say the success level has been as far as crowds, as far as interest, all of that? You know, in the U.S., it's certainly getting a ton of attention as they're in the finals once again.
Yeah, I think it's been fantastic, really, for women's soccer and you know, giving it more of a global profile. If you look at ticket sales, I think FIFA have been pretty happy with that. There have been a few little stories about, you know, some of the stadiums used perhaps didn't have the best public transport infrastructure. Perhaps some of the host cities weren't getting behind the idea of hosting a World Cup as much as they could have. But generally, yeah, I think ticket sales have been strong. Obviously, the final is going to be a huge sellout. I think media coverage internationally has been fantastic. TV audiences in the United Kingdom, for example, when England played, I think it was the highest peak audience for a match on the BBC this year, and that's for the highest program, sorry, not even a sporting event. So to me, that's fantastic and shows you how far you know, the women's game has come. And as you said, obviously having the United States do so well and get to the final again, and, you know, particularly the favourites as well to win again, I think that's great because it brings in that international audience and, you know, it really shows the players as stars, and hopefully it can kickstart the women's game again around the world.
How would you say the Americans are perceived internationally? Because, you know, some people, there's been a lot of talk about you're puffing out your chest too much, you're winning 12-0, and you're still celebrating goals. That's makes sure. America look bad. What, from your perspective, what would you say?
It's a tricky one, isn't it? I mean, I think, you know, obviously there's a fine line between overconfidence and, you know, what some people have perceived as arrogance. I mean, I think, like, if you look at Alex Morgan's tea-sipping celebration the other day, which, you know, I'm a Brit, I thought that was quite funny. I mean, I think we want our sports people to have a bit of personality, don't we? We want them to be able to do something like that and not have to, you know, get upset. I think if people are getting upset by that, really there's more important things to focus on. But certainly, you know, I think the Americans have come with the attitude that they're going to win the tournament, that they think they're the best team. And ultimately they have to back that up. And, you know, they've got all the way to the final. It hasn't all been clear sailing, but they've got there. And if they win again, I think that overconfidence is justified, really.
Yeah. Robert Kidd wrapping it up here. Freelance journalist Valencia, Spain, with us here on the opening bell, 720 WGN. Just back to the VAR before we go. Is there a next step in technology that you're aware of that can be even better than the VAR, or is this pretty much what we've got going forward and they'll just have to work out the kinks on when they use it and when they don't?
Yeah, I think that's the key. I think it's going to be using this technology because the technology really works fine. I mean, video replays, usually you can tell it's going to be working out those kinks, like you say, and I guess grappling with the idea of making decisions that are so open to interpretation. I mean, I think the thing about VAR and soccer in general is because a lot of these decisions are open to interpretation, no referee can get 100% of the decisions correct 100% of the time. And that's just something I think we have to accept moving forward.
Yep, they're human beings too. All right, Robert, great stuff. Appreciate you jumping on this morning. And what time is it right now for you?
It's 10 to 1 in the afternoon.
All right, I don't have to really, really thank you. That's normal time. You're right in the middle of your day, Robert.
Exactly.
Thanks for jumping on, and enjoy the final coming up here. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mark.
All right, Robert Kidd, freelance journalist, Valencia, Spain, beautiful part of the world. Let us take a quick timeout, and we'll come on back here with a little look at the numbers here. It's the opening bell on 720 WGN.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
Going to talk to Orion Samuelson in a moment here, a little agriculture, a little commodities. Welcome back to the opening bell on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. S&P 500, the minis are trending down 4.25 points. The Dow is trending down 31 points, and the NASDAQ is down 14.25 points as we bring in Orion Samuelson. Orion, good morning. Happy 4th of July to you.
And good morning to you, and you did not play with firecrackers, I hope, over the 4th, because you'll just get hurt if you do, so I hope you made it through that okay.
I did, and I was on yesterday afternoon, Orion, and I told everybody, don't exactly what you just said. Listen, you get injured, leave it to the professionals. There's no need for this. So, anyway, I was snuggled at home, Orion, watching Dean Richards on WGN TV.
Yep.
Bring me the
we
fireworks.
The same.
Yeah. So let's talk about JB Pritzker. Yes, on yesterday, or actually 2 days ago now. He's urging U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue to declare a disaster across Illinois after months of tons of rains that we're having here. So what's going on, Orion? Is this a true disaster that we're dealing with?
Well, it's no. A disaster you can't recover from, for months, years, and so on. We are going to face a smaller crop because of the late planting, and the later you plant, the lower the per acre yield. And so we're going through that right now. But it's amazing what happens when you get degree day units, and we have gotten some very hot, humid temperatures. I live about half a mile from a cornfield here near Huntley, Illinois, and that corn has literally jumped about 12 to 15 inches in the last 3 days. It's just amazing because of the seed technology that can deal with so much of this. But we had quite a day before the 4th of July, because traders were sort of evening up their positions ahead of the holiday. We had corn up 19.25 cents in the July contract on the day before the 4th, on Wednesday. We had wheat up 15 cents, and we had soybeans up 9.5 cents. And much of that was technical buying, but much of that was really what we call squaring up positions ahead of a trading holiday, because that always makes traders nervous when we go into a 3-day weekend or a holiday in midweek, because something can happen, and with the markets closed, you can't do anything to protect your position. But we are recovering, and I think it'll be a different kind of a year because of the timing factor, but it will happen. And the other news that's coming into the market this this morning is the talks between China and the United States on trade, and that is going to get underway really very soon. Top representatives from the U.S. and China will meet in the coming week to continue trade talks between China and the United States. And Mr. Kutlow has told reporters those talks will continue in earnest this coming week. The two sides have already been in communications by phone. President Trump and President Xi have agreed during a meeting in Japan last week to relaunch the talks that had stalled in May. So we are going to be very interested in what happens in that situation. Meanwhile, we have folks who like to check in with us and call and talk to us about what's going on. And our downstate reporter checked in with me to say that the barges on the Mississippi and the Illinois are all over because they didn't open the locks and the dams on the rivers until about 2 weeks ago. And since they had been closed since November, the backup of barges taking grain down the river to New Orleans and then bringing supplies like crop protection and fertilizer and other supplies up the river to get into hands of farmers didn't take place. And so my downfield, downstate reporter said, there are loaded and empty barges stacked everywhere along the river in Peoria through Pekin and seeing several cornfields starting to tassel. So that's some of the challenges that we're undergoing right now.
Big O, great to hear you. Happy 4th of July. Thanks for the info.
Yeah, I tell you what, tomorrow Gary Pack of Twin Garden Farms will be on to tell us when that great Mirai sweet corn will be available at farmers markets. We'll have that for you tomorrow.
Oh, people are waiting for that. It's the best. Happy 4th, Big O.
Okay, same to you.
All right, Orion Samuelson with us here on 720 WGN. Let's do one more check on the WGN Associated Bank Mark Desk Outlook for today. We got a jobs report coming up. Economists expect to see 165,000 jobs were added in June. There was only 75,000 payrolls added in May, which was surprisingly low. So that job report coming out later today. Let's take our final timeout on the opening bell, 720 WGN.